My name is David Wee. This session is entitled Poetry, Perversion, and Madness. I need to know how many came for the poetry and how many came for the perversion. Okay. Basically, what I intend for tonight is to have a relatively informal introduction to some poetry, to the way poetry works, and to talk through, to hear and then talk through half a dozen poems. One of the nice things about having a session like this is that I can pick some of my favorite poems, or ones that illustrate certain things, and be able to read them and help you enjoy them, and then talk about them a bit. All month long in class, we've been talking about fiction, and many of the things that writers of fiction do are common to things that writers of poetry do, but there are major differences, especially in length, between most poems and most fiction. You all should have a handout, and we'll read those, and I want you to look at them closely as we talk about them as we go along. And we'll hold this session to something less than an hour.
Do you have any extras?
There are some extras back on the chair back there. First, I'll explain the title of the session by making reference to one of the stories that the class read a few weeks ago when we began this course on fiction. It's a story called How Beautiful with Shoes. It's one of my favorite short stories. One reason I like it is not only because it tells a good story, but because it's about the effect of art, and in specific poetry, upon human beings. It dramatizes the effect that good literature can have on us. It's a story called How Beautiful with Shoes by Wilbur Daniel Steele. And very quickly, it's about a young farm woman. She's probably 20 years old, something like that, living in Carolina. Her name is Amarantha, but everyone calls her Mare. Her boyfriend is another farmer from the next farm over. His name is Ruby, but he's not a jewel by any means. The woman is very much a person of the earth. She goes barefoot most of the time. We meet her. She's described as a wooden girl. She responds relatively slowly. And the farm people in the story are emphasized in terms of their relationship to the land and to animals. A stranger comes to Amarantha's farm asking for her. She meets him, and he says, "Amarantha, that's poetry." And the next line is, "She knew that she did not know him." Anyone who would hear her name and say, "That's poetry," was someone totally unconnected with her social world. Well, this person turns out to be a loony, as he's called in the story, a crazy person named Humble Jewett, who has been an English teacher, who was teaching biblical poetry to his classes. The principal of his school told him he wasn't allowed to do this. He had a vision from God that he should go and kill the principal, who was also having an affair with one of the schoolgirls. So he has become a killer. He is crazy. And he is constantly referred to as the loony. Well, he kidnaps Amarantha because he's fascinated by her name and by her hair. And as he is going off with her in the countryside, he keeps reciting poetry to her. And he is reciting poems that some of you know. He recites from Lovelace, a 17th century British poet, "Amarantha, sweet and fair, oh, braid no more that shining hair." And he unbraids Amarantha's hair, lets it flow freely. He recites the poetry of the love poetry of the Song of Solomon to her. How beautiful are thy feet with shoes, O prince's daughter, and on and on. Amarantha has never heard any language like this before, but she's frightened to death because she's afraid she's going to be raped or killed. Finally, people hunt them down, and after a series of events, humble Jewett is shot to death. And the story ends as Amarantha is back in her room, trying to come out of the shock and try to come to grips with her experience. And as she reaches down to pull the shoes off her feet, she had put on her Sunday go-to-meeting shoes earlier in the day because a judge was going to come to the house. And she forgot to take them off, so that they've been pinching her feet for these hours as she's been traipsing through the countryside. She starts to take her feet off, her shoes off her feet, and all of a sudden, the line, how beautiful are thy feet with shoes, O prince's daughter. She pulls her shoes back on. She doesn't want to take them off. She begins to compare the way the poetry spoken to her contrasts with the way Ruby, her boyfriend, speaks to her and slaps her on the rear and says, give me a kiss, and, you know, wipes his mouth on his sleeve. And she has discovered a whole new understanding of life, what it is to be a human being. She has discovered beauty, and it's all been through the words of poetry spoken by a crazy person. People tend to think of poets as being strange and weird. I remember when I was in college, when a poet came to campus to speak, you know, I was just sort of awestruck and wouldn't have gone near the person with 10-foot poles, because here was a real poet. Now I'm married to one, and I have a different attitude toward poets. But the general public tends to think of poems and poetry as something strange, something beyond the ordinary. And I'd like to address that a little bit. I'd like you to look at the poem called Praise in Summer by Richard Wilbur. I'm going to read each poem aloud before we start discussing it, because I think most of you know poetry ought to be read aloud, just as fiction is often best read aloud, as Karen demonstrated a little while ago. But poetry is designed partly because of the way the syllables roll off the tongue, the way the sounds affect us, not just the sense of the words. This is a sonnet. Most of you know what sonnets are, 14-line poems with certain rhyme schemes and orders of organization. Obscurely, yet most surely called to praise, as sometimes summer calls us all, I said, the hills are heavens, full of branching ways, where star-nosed moles fly overhead the dead. I said, the trees are mines in air. I said, see how the sparrow burrows in the sky. And then I wondered why this mad instead perverts our praise to uncreation. Why such savors in this wrenching things awry? Does sense so stale that it must needs derange the world to know it? To a praiseful eye, should it not be enough of fresh and strange that trees grow green and moles can course in clay and sparrows sweep the ceiling of our day? Now here's the situation in the poem, and by the way, interrupt at any time with questions or your own observations or responses. This is a poem, and most poems require several readings and some time to ponder them, so I don't expect you to interpret them right off the bat. But here we have the speaker, who, as many of us, as he says, it happens to all of us at various times, feels the impulse to praise nature. It happens to us out here all the time. Obscurely yet most surely called to praise, as sometimes summer calls us all. I felt the need to praise nature. What did I say? Well, here's what he tells us he said when trying to praise summer and nature. I said, the hills are heavens. Now, what I'd like you to try to do is visualize what picture, what word picture the speaker has created when he's tried to praise summer and nature. What he's done is actually turn the world upside down. He says, the hills are heavens full of branching ways where star-nosed moles fly overhead the dead. He's taken, if you can imagine, the earth down here, the sky up here, he's turned that upside down. So now the hills, the earth, are the heavens. They're up there, and the heavens are down below. And star-nosed moles, which normally are burrowing beneath the graves, supposedly, you know, if they're 10 feet down and graves are 6 feet down, why, the moles are down there. If you turn the world upside down, the moles are flying overhead the dead. They're above graves instead of below them. There are such things as star-nosed moles, and it's appropriate that the poet has picked them because then there seem to be, metaphorically at least, stars in the heavens. I said, the trees are mines in air. I said, see how the sparrow burrows in the sky. Again, the world is upside down. Trees, which normally go up, you know, with a main shaft and then branching shafts. Now, with this upside down world, the trees are mines. They're like a mine shaft. Mm-hmm. Here at Holden, we think often about mines. See how the sparrow burrows in the sky. If the sparrow had earlier been flying overhead trees, now in this upside down world, the sparrow is burrowing, and the mole that used to burrow is now flying overhead the dead. So what the poet has done here in trying to praise what nature is like has turned the world upside down and changed it all around. And naturally, the speaker wonders, why did I do this? What made me do that? And then I wondered. And here are the words, one of the words, both the words for my title tonight. I wondered why this mad instead perverts our praise to uncreation. He's seen what he's done as perversion. He's perverted the world. He hasn't described it the way it is, but perverted it. It's a mad instead. It's a kind of insane, not reality, but unreality. It's not telling what things are like, but he's created an instead of something else. And it seems to be insane. It's mad. And when we're trying to praise, we uncreate instead of create. In a sense, he's taken creation apart and done it a different way. Why, in this next line, the syntax is a little complicated. I'll paraphrase it. Why there is such savor, why such savors in this wrenching things awry? Why is there such fun, such good taste? Why does it feel so good, taste so good, to wrench things awry instead of tell it like it is? Then he asks the key question, does sense so stale that it must needs derange the world to know it? Are our senses of sight, of sound, taste, of smell, are they so stale that in order to know the world, that is to understand it, to perceive it, do we have to derange the world? Do we have to pervert it? Do we have to do this insane, turning it upside down, inside out, whatever? Then he seems to answer the question with a rhetorical question. Should it not be enough of fresh and strange that trees grow green and moles can course in clay and sparrows sweep the ceiling of our day? Isn't it enough to describe the world exactly as it is? But notice, and most of us when we read this for the first time, we think, yeah, it's good enough to take a photograph of the world exactly the way it is. We see its beauty. That's enough, and poetry perhaps should not do these bizarre upside down, inside out images, but describe the world as it really is. But notice what he does in the last line. And sparrows sweep the ceiling of our day. he's gone back to another metaphor. And this is a poem about metaphors, you see. We use some different image to talk about a particular thing. And it's not enough, Richard Wilbur is saying, it's not enough to say the trees grow green. Our senses are so stale. This is what the poet believes, what the writer of fiction believes, what the literary artist believes. Human senses are so stale, we're so dull to the beauty and other things about our world, that it takes perverting the world, writing stories about things that never happened, creating characters that perhaps never lived, using metaphors, saying, greasing the skids when we're talking about something entirely different, using metaphor in order to make us see the world. If the last line of this poem had read, "Shouldn't it be enough of fresh and strange that sparrows fly through the sky?" You see, the answer would have been much differently. But sparrows don't sweep. They don't have brooms. The sky is not a ceiling. Our day doesn't have a ceiling. This is another perversion, another metaphor. And it seems to me that what Richard Wilbur is saying here is that the whole function of literary art is to make us see things, to bring our senses alive. And the poet, the literary artist, does that through metaphor, through creating pictures, so that suddenly we look at something in a different way. You read this poem, and the next time you look at a certain trees, you say, "By golly, that does look like a mine, what I imagine a mine shaft to be," and I can imagine that going on. Or you imagine that there are moles down there, doggone it, crawling around, burrowing all the time, and I never think about it. You begin to notice the shapes of things, the colors of things. Alice Walker says, you know, God's upset if we don't notice the color purple when we walk through a field. Richard Wilbur is saying the same thing, that we don't even notice most of what's going on in our world as we walk around in it. And poets are constantly trying to knock us over the head and make us see things in a different way by using metaphors, by perversions, by turning the world upside down, in the hopes that we'll wake up, we'll open up, we'll discover the beauty that we haven't seen before because our senses are so stale. Look at Nothing Gold Can Stay by Robert Frost, a very simple poem. Nature's first green is gold, her hardest hue to hold. Her early leaf's a flower, but only so an hour. Then leaf subsides to leaf. So Eden sank to grief, so dawn goes down to day. Nothing gold can stay. I like this poem for a number of reasons. I don't like what it says, but I like the way it works. I like what Robert Frost does with it. I disagree with what Robert Frost says. And that's something that often happens in literature. You can disagree with the vision of a writer, even if you happen to like the work of art that the person has created, or vice versa. On first glance, if we look at this and we read as literalists, and most of us tend to read things literally, you have to ask, what in the world does it mean to say the first green is gold? We know that green is not gold, right? Green is green. So we have a kind of paradox here. It doesn't make logical sense to say this. It's been a long time since I've studied botany, but I think it's still true that a leaf is not a flower. Line 3 says, her early leaf is a flower. And we know that a leaf and a flower are two different parts of a plant, not the same thing. Another seeming paradox. Well, I think we all recognize that this is simply use of metaphor. And this is what poets do a lot. They will say a leaf is a flower, and we understand what that means. When we say the first green is gold, we understand it's not talking about color, but about what? What statement does the first line say? Nature's first green is gold.
It's nice.
It's nice, okay.
Valuable.
Valuable, okay. Gold is one of the most valuable ores. At least human beings have attached special value to it, and it's part of expensive coinage and so forth, jewelry. So everything that gold suggests to us in terms of value, preciousness, is what the writer is trying to get at here. So to say the first green is gold is to say it's very nice or it's valuable, it's precious, it's worth a lot. This kind of use of language is not exclusive to poets. One thing I hope that we all understand is that if we say, well, poets are people who use metaphors, then we have to identify ourselves, all of us, as poets, because we all use metaphoric language. It's not mysterious. You know, we shouldn't hold poets in awe for certain things that they do anyway. I mean, you've all referred to, used the phrase, it was a golden opportunity, right? You're being poetic, the way some people use that word, because you're just speaking metaphorically. There was no color gold related to your opportunity. It was just a good one, a special one, a precious one, and you let it go by. Or if you say, you know, my roommate's a hot dog, you're using metaphor. In fact, you're using a kind of metaphor on top of a metaphor. What do we say when my roommate's a hot dog? What do we mean? A show-off, okay? What is a hot dog really? It's a wiener in a bun, right? And that in itself is a metaphor. Because hot dog literally means an overheated canine. And to call this a wiener in a bun a hot dog is to use a metaphor for that bit of food. And then to use that as another metaphor for a show-off is building metaphor out of metaphor. It's common language. Many of our cliches, greasing the skids, are metaphors, and we're all poets when we engage in that. So what we recognize is that here Robert Frost is saying the first green in nature, probably the earliest stuff that shows up in the springtime, is gold. Her hardest hue to hold. Is there any holding going on? Any grasping? We've got another metaphor here, haven't we? What does it mean to say this is the hardest hue to hold? Doesn't mean, you know, that we lose our grip. But here, and that's exactly how we generally respond to the newness and the freshness of it. But he's saying that the color itself doesn't last very long. Our excitement doesn't either, but neither does that hue, that early green. The next two lines are parallel to the first two. Another metaphor, in case we didn't get it in the first one. Her early leaf's a flower. And we commonly use a flower to represent beauty, something special. The reason we send flowers to loved ones on special occasions is because it's a symbol of beauty and preciousness again. We say things like, my love is like a red, red rose. You know, we know it has nothing to do with flowers. It has to do with freshness, beauty, preciousness. But only so an hour. And again, the poet isn't being literal. It's not that it's for 60 minutes, but an hour means a short time. And again, we all speak like this, right? I'm coming in a minute. And 20 minutes later, you know, you come. Or just a sec. And you're talking about minutes, not seconds. Or it was years before she arrived, you know, and the person was 20 minutes late. So we all use one time to indicate a totally different kind of time. So the first four lines in this poem are filled with metaphors, common ones, saying that the first green that shows up in the springtime is very precious, but only briefly so. And then the heat of midsummer comes, and what happens? Then leaf subsides to leaf, so Eden sank to grief, so dawn goes down to day, nothing gold can stay. Now notice the verbs in the next three lines. Subsides, sank, goes down. They're all verbs of descending. Is he talking about descending through space? Leaf subsides to leaf. Is that saying that the leaves are falling? So Eden sank to grief. Is there any sinking going on? Really, the going down is all a diminishment of quality, isn't it? These are, again, metaphors for losing quality. Leaf subsides to leaf suggests that the later leaves, when they dry up and start getting crinkly, they've lost that early preciousness. Eden sank to grief. There's no sinking in some cosmic sea, as far as I know, but grief happened. And notice that grief is the only emotional word, the only word that identifies an emotion, and the only word that really identifies humanness in here. Everything else is botanical or cosmic. The word grief is the only thing that we can associate specifically with human experience. So Eden sank to grief. Robert Frost has taken simple botanical truth and extended it to human. He's made a theological statement now that in the Garden of Eden there was an early perfection, and it has subsided to grief. There's been a diminishment in quality, a loss of innocence, the introduction of sin and grief. So dawn goes down today. He makes another analogy, saying dawn goes down. It's a strange language to use. We generally think of dawn as coming up, the sun coming up at least. But he's saying that dawn diminishes in quality, and midday is not the same kind of early preciousness that dawn has. Some of us haven't seen very many dawns, and you know, might not be able to verify this. But he's saying that dawn goes down today, that dawn is more precious. It's one of those early things that becomes something lesser as the day proceeds. And then he sums up by saying nothing gold can stay, saying that those things that are especially precious at their earliest moment don't last. They don't stay. Everything diminishes in quality. And everything that the poem has said up to that point through metaphor and almost all through botany, with an extension to theology and an extension to the cosmos, to the cycles of day and night, are intended to say the same thing. You know, I disagree that all things in their early freshness gradually diminish in quality. Don't think that's true. But I think the poem makes that statement very effectively, very simply. But we can't read it literally, or immediately we get into extreme problems. I think it's obvious in a simple poem like this that we can see what a poet is doing with metaphor, with paradox, with using botany to talk about sinfulness and so forth. But this is basically what poets are doing in all sorts of larger, more complicated poems, and I thought you could see it simply here. Jackie, did you have a question?
I just wanted to accept her early leaves of flower, it usually is. Those little buds, they open up, there's usually three or four little leaves, and they're usually red or gold, and it usually is like a flower, until each leaf becomes an individual leaf.
Well, you've made one difference there, and you said it's like a flower. And I agree with you, but there's a difference between saying it's like a flower and saying that it is a flower. That's the difference between metaphor and simile. And you're right, we think that, you know, say a piece of grass coming up, sort of curled, does look flower-like, but it still isn't a flower. I think that's the difference here. Yeah, Barb.
I was going to say that too, but the first line, "Nature's first green is gold," I discussed this poem once before, and we thought it moved. It could be metaphorical at first, but also literal, and gradually moves to being only metaphorical. Because in the springtime, everything does look sort of gold for a couple days, and the buds are just showing. It's like, that is nature's first green. And if you look at trees that are budding, they look sort of gold.
Does other people's experience verify that? That the first colors you see is gold, not green or yellow or. Okay. It's a yellow. Okay. 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 Yeah. Chartreuse, okay. Not all plants have the exact same color when they come. And I think Frost is trying to make a universal statement here. And yeah, okay. That one we better not debate for too long or we wouldn't get on. I'll look at Humpty Dumpty. We all know this poem by heart, but here it is. Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall. Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. And all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty Dumpty together again. It's been marvelous, some of the discussions of this poem that I've had with people. Who is Humpty Dumpty? Henry the Eighth?
Okay.
Any other ideas about who Humpty Dumpty is? An egg? Okay, now. See how hard it is to interpret poetry. We get right off the bat. Any other ideas? Peter?
Humanity?
Okay. See, we're getting into thicker trouble as we go. This is one of the difficulties of studying poetry and just reading it for ourselves. When a poet tries to say something through metaphor by calling a tree a mine or saying that a sparrow burrows or saying that a leaf is a flower, saying that Eden sank, we recognize that the poet is using one image, usually something concrete, to talk about something else that may be abstract or some other concrete thing. The metaphor is an image that stands not only for itself, but it stands for something else. In other words, poetry works through indirection. You say one thing, but indirectly you're talking about something else. And in trying to make the leap from the concrete image to that often abstract idea is where all the differing interpretations come. We all leap off into different directions, just like we have here with Humpty Dumpty. Well, you know, our kids have always known that Humpty Dumpty is an egg. And some of my students are always arguing that it's Henry VIII or someone else. So we get into good discussions about it, and I've always thought about bringing my children when they were 3 years old to come to class with me and tell the class who Humpty Dumpty is. And it's he's an egg. How do we know that Humpty Dumpty is an egg?
There's a picture of it in Mother Moon.
Okay. Well, that's what we call external evidence, right? It's not from the lines of the poem, but from an illustrator. I do have a nursery rhyme book that shows Humpty Dumpty as a little boy sitting on the wall, but most of them have an egg with, you know, coat and collar and little hat, funny little pants. Okay. We know that Humpty Dumpty is an egg simply by the cultural baggage we've inherited. Do you know why? Where this came from? What kind of poem is this?
Nursery rhyme.
It's a nursery rhyme. It has another function as well.
A riddle?
It's a riddle. That's right. It's a riddle. Tell this poem, and the thing is to guess, well, who is Humpty Dumpty? Who would it be who would sit on a wall, have a great fall, and all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put it back together again? Well, why should it be an egg rather than something else? Can't put an egg together when we break it, and that's why this is the answer. Now notice, this is hundreds of years old. I haven't found any source that knows exactly the first appearance of this, but let's assume that it's hundreds of years ago when the egg was probably as good an image of anything that people and children especially knew about, that had properties of not being able to put it back together into its original form after it's broken. If someone were trying to create a riddle like this today, why, Humpty Dumpty might be a vacuum tube or, you know, some other thing that would be even harder than egg to put back together again. So it's a riddle, and the job of the listener to this nursery rhyme riddle is to figure out who is Humpty Dumpty. Answer is an egg, so the illustrators have portrayed this person as an egg. Well, once we start being English majors and thinking about symbols and metaphors, we start to do more with it than that. One English major says Humpty Dumpty is humanity, was Peter's word. Why would we make that kind of a claim on this poor little egg sitting on the wall? Or why would the poet perhaps have that in mind, or a reader? Well, if we want this to not just be about eggs, but to be about us, this is what we do when we start to insist that images are not only about themselves, but about some other thing, such as human behavior. Having something fall off a wall and break, and then not being able to be put back together by all the king's horses and all the king's men. I chuckle to think of those horses trying to put the egg back together. But obviously all the king's horses and all the king's men, at the time this riddle was first created, probably was as good an image, metaphor, for human power as society had at the time. In other words, there's no human power that could redeem this situation, that could reverse what has happened. And that is, when certain steps get taken, when certain accidents happen, there's no power on earth that can return things to the original state. Christians start thinking, good metaphor for the fall. And we've even got the word right in there. If we were writing this today, you know, instead of all the king's horses, we might use what metaphor? All of Reagan's missiles, you know, couldn't change what fall, what mistake, what accident has happened. Humpty Dumpty can be a chilling kind of poem for our current situation. If the egg, a kind of head-shaped but featureless thing, is a good image of humanity, generalized humanity, because it's head-shaped but not distinguished into certain features, we can think about this poem in our nuclear age as a chilling poem about what we don't want to happen. We don't want this egg to fall off the wall and be in a situation where no earthly powers can change what happens. But basically, the poem is metaphoric. It's a riddle, and the answer is an egg. But as with much literature, the poem seems to say more than the original designers, the original makers of it, intended. And we ingenious humans start to associate the images, a wall being something high, suggesting something like pride, if you're up too high, if you're in a place where you shouldn't be. Eggs do not have physical qualities such that they can sit on walls with impunity. They will fall off. If we try to do something or get someplace where we have no business being, there's a good chance that there will be a fall with irreversible consequences, at least irreversible by human power. So, and I'm sure that whoever first phrased this never had anything like that in mind. But metaphors work that way on us, and we begin to use them to carry meaning that may not have even been intended at the original creation. Okay, let's look at God's Grandeur by Gerard Manley Hopkins. Oh, question. Linda, did you have a question?
I was going to say, the name carries a promise of new life. And if it falls, it can't do that. And if it blows the world apart, it's done.
Yep, exactly. That's right. That's why the egg is a better image than, say, a vacuum tube or something. It functions much better. Here's a poem, God's Grandeur, written in the 19th century, written about 100 years ago, almost exactly 100 years ago, by a priest. Yet I find this to be a totally current, relevant ecology poem, and a theological poem. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed. Why do men then now not wreck his rod? Generations have trod, have trod, have trod, and all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil. And wears man's smudge, and shares man's smell. The soil is bare now, nor can foot feel being shod. And for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things. And though the last lights off the black west went, O morning at the brown brink eastward springs, because the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with warm breast and with, bright wings. Well, we could talk about this a long time, but let's just look quickly at some of the elements. It's a sonnet, just like Praise in Summer was a sonnet. And if you look at the way it rhymes, you notice one of the typical sonnet rhyme schemes. I like Hopkins partly because he likes to pun so much, and I love puns. When he says the world is charged with the grandeur of God, he means the word charged in at least three different meanings, probably several more. What does the word charged mean here?
With electricity.
Okay, charged with electricity, like we charge batteries. In other words, the world is invigorated or enlivened with the grandeur of God. What other meaning of charged? Yeah, Judy?
Moved upon or attacked.
Okay, just sort of overwhelmed. So when at a football game we say da-da-da-da-da-da, charge. I mean, you know, just almost run over, overwhelmed, okay? What else? At least one other key meaning of the word charged here. Yeah, Nathan? Okay. Yeah, given the responsibility, as it's, you know, I charge you to do this. All those things, The word is used here, we have to understand it in all those meanings. This is another thing that poets do so well, is that they use words not only in their most immediate, obvious meaning, but since poets are word lovers, they are always sensitive to the multiple meanings of words, and they'll use words in two or three ways all at the same time. Or they'll use a word in a way that we don't generally use it anymore. And we have to be alert to those things. Hopkins is talking about the relationship of human beings with the grandeur of the created world. Talks about, he uses a couple of metaphors in how this grandeur manifests itself. It flames out. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed. God forces us to think about where we see and how we see God's grandeur. And he asks the question, why do men then now not wreck his rod? More metaphors, more punning here. When he says, why do men then, he means therefore, or because of this, why then? It's a logical word. It also means then, as in the past, and now, in the present. He puts together then, now. So he's saying, why in the past and why right now don't human beings, and God has a rod, which is a symbol of what?
Judgment.
Okay, what else?
Power.
Sovereignty.
Okay. Leadership.
Okay. And maybe somebody said it. You spare the rod, you spoil the child, discipline or punishment. Okay, I wasn't sure I'd heard that. He asks, why don't, given the grandeur of God, why don't and why haven't human beings given allegiance, paid attention to God? And then he goes into these highly rhymed and alliterative statements about what we've done to the earth.
Is wreck just short for reckon? Reckon with? Is he just trying to make his sonnet work?
Not exactly. It's the same as the root of recognize, as give attention to or allegiance to. It's when you recognize another country, you recognize its authority, as its independence, and so forth. Look at the language in the next four lines about what it is that we have done to the earth. We bleared it, smeared it, seared it. And the earth now wears man's smudge. Hopkins is using man in the non-inclusive way 100 years ago. Well, it's true that most of the smudging and the smearing and so forth was done by males, that's right. But there were a lot of working class women in those days. And we've made the soil bare. And the foot is shod. Instead of being barefoot in the soil, soil bearing things and having bare feet and close contact with the earth, we've bared the earth and we've shod our feet. And we can't feel. We put something between ourselves and the created earth. And we've seared and smeared the earth. So it's an image of the separation of humans from the created world. And then he says, and I'm not sure he'd say this if he wrote this poem today, in spite of all this, nature is never spent. And he uses the strange imagery and strange language to say that the created world has got too much freshness, too much of this grandeur for our human beings to use it up. We can't ruin this earth, he's saying. And even though things look dark, if we turn and look to the east, we see the dawn breaking. And the reason is, and here we have an image of, I think, female nurturing, the Holy Ghost. It's not the Holy Ghost that bends, the world is bent. Over the bent world, the Holy Ghost broods with warm breast. Image of God as the mother hen, or the brooding image and the warm breast suggests that to me. God is looking over and protecting this world, and that we aren't going to be able to damage it completely. Well, it's fun to listen to that poem and just hear the language of it. But I want to get on to a couple more, too. Mm-hmm. One of the most puzzling writers is E.E. Cummings. If you've tried to read E.E. Cummings' poetry, it's kind of poetry that gets very confusing because he does such strange things with the syntax and punctuation and capitalization that you really have to work hard. His words go all over the page. This one, anyone lived in a pretty how town. It has a kind of sing-song rhythm to it. It sounds like a child's song, and yet it's a very serious poem about human relationships and love. And I want you to notice a few things as I read it. It's a 9 stanza poem, and it's a cyclical poem. It's not a linear poem, but it moves in cycles. The first stanza is about anyone. And here Cummings likes to pun a lot, too. Anyone is both the name of a person, and it's an indefinite pronoun. Second stanza is about women and men. Third stanza is about children. Then the cycle is repeated. Fourth stanza is about no one, who is anyone's friend. The fifth stanza is about someone's, those are the women and men. And the sixth stanza is about the children again. And then the last 3 stanzas are about anyone and no one. And then there isn't another stanza about children. And there's another stanza about women and men, grown-ups. Children aren't there in this last cycle, which is part of what Cummings is trying to show us, that children have grown up. Anyone lived in a pretty how town with up so floating many bells down. Spring, summer, autumn, winter, he sang his didn't, he danced his did. Women and men, both little and small, cared for anyone not at all. They sowed their isn't, they reaped their same, sun, moon, stars, rain. Children guessed, but only a few, and down they forgot as up they grew. Autumn, winter, spring, summer, that no one loved him more by more. When by now and tree by leaf, she laughed his joy, she cried his grief. Bird by snow and stir by still, anyone's any was all to her. Someone's married their everyone's, laughed their cryings and did their dance. Sleep, wake, hope, and then they said their nevers, they slept their dream. Stars, rain, sun, moon, and only the snow can begin to explain how children are apt to forget to remember with up so floating many bells down. One day anyone died, I guess, and no one stooped to kiss his face. Notice that means both nobody did, but the person named no one did. Busy folk buried them side by side, little by little and was by was, all by all and deep by deep, and more by more they dream their sleep. No one and anyone, earth by April, wish by spirit and if by yes. Women and men, both dong and ding, summer, autumn, winter, spring, reaped their sowing and went their came, sun, moon, stars, rain. A lot of things are going on in that poem. You can see the cyclical patterns of the seasons, elements of the cosmos, sun, moon, stars, rain. You have to pay close attention to all these pronouns, the anyone, the no one, the someones. Sometimes they're being used as the names of people, and they're also being used as those indefinite pronouns. And at the same time, they mean both of those. Notice what Cummings says about children. The poem is really about a love relationship between anyone and no one, and the children are the ones who guessed that no one loved him more by more. The adults don't, but notice that the children grow up. one of the key things in here is that children, down they forgot as up they grew. As we grow up, we tend to move away from our intuitions and perceptions about nature and the world, and we become over-civilized. And the children are gone from the last part of the poem, and women and men, they have become the women and men by the last cycle of this. You notice that there are two periods and two capital letters in the poem. Women and men at the start of the second stanza, women and men at the start of the last stanza, immediately following the period. The poem, this suggests that the poem just keeps going from the last stanza right back to the first one again. Patterns of living and dying and ignoring and forgetting are repeated. You have to pay attention to the prepositions and the ways in which Cummings constantly perverts our cliches. The people do their dance, but anyone danced is dead. It's always twisting the cliches around, and we have to read them and think about them and notice them in special ways. Well, that one would be fun to talk about in more details. But basically, he's talking about the importance, the quality of love relationship between individuals in the midst of an impersonal and conventional society. Then let's finish with very brief discussion of, I guess there are just two others that I haven't done here. Back on the other side, the poem by Robinson, How Annandale Went Out. Another sonnet, very carefully structured rhyme scheme, and sonnets have got 10 syllables in each line and a very regular rhythm. Hard to write because the form is prescribed so much. I don't know if you can tell on a quick reading. I'll read the poem first and see if you know what the topic is. Maybe it's quite evident. They called it Annandale, and I was there to flourish, to find words, and to attend. Liar, physician, hypocrite, and friend, I watched him. And the sight was not so fair as one or two that I had seen elsewhere. An apparatus not for me to mend, a wreck, with hell between him and the end, remained of Annandale. And I was there. I knew the ruin as I knew the man. So put the two together if you can, remembering the worst you know of me. Now view yourself as I was, on the spot, with a slight kind of engine. Do you see? Like this. You wouldn't hang me? I thought not. Poem is spoken by a doctor. He's a physician, amongst several other labels he gives himself early in the poem, watching the death struggles of a friend who has become a wreck. He's dying some painful death. And the speaker decides to end his life, probably with a shot. The slight kind of engine is probably a hypodermic needle. And the physician says, you know, knowing what you know of me, watching my best friend, and knew what he was like in health, watching him struggle to a painful death, I did this. I put him out of his misery. You wouldn't hang me? I thought not. It's a poem trying to justify, what's the term we give to?
Euthanasia,
thank you. It's a poem about euthanasia, done by a physician. This poem, too, is perhaps 100 years old. And I think a very poignant and effective way of raising the whole issue and the emotional problem connected with euthanasia. Then here's my favorite love poem, except for a couple that Karen has written. This poem I like because it's such a celebration of inept people. Any time that you consider yourself clumsy, awkward, really out of it and you don't like yourself for it, pull this poem out and notice how it expresses love for the important qualities about a person. I think the speaker is male. Yeah, the male speaker talking about the woman he loves. My clumsiest dear. And notice the bizarre metaphors that this lover uses to address his loved one, not the conventional ones. My clumsiest dear, whose hands shipwreck vases, at whose quick touch all glasses chip and ring, whose palms are bowls in china, burrs in linen, and have no cunning with any soft thing, except all ill at ease fidgeting people. The refugee uncertain at the door, you make at home. Deftly you steady the drunk, clambering on his undulant floor. Unpredictable dear, the taxi driver's terror, shrinking from far headlights, pale as a dime, yet leaping before red apoplectic streetcars, misfit in any space, and never on time. A wrench in clocks and the solar system. Only with words and people and love you move at ease. In traffic of wit, expertly maneuver and keep us all devotion at your knees. Forgetting your coffee spreading on our flannel. It's a British word for blanket. Your lipstick grinning on our coat. So gaily in love's unbreakable heaven, our souls on glory of spilt bourbon float. Be with me, darling, early and late. Smash glasses. I will study rye music for your sake. For should your hands drop white and empty, all the toys of the world would break. It's almost time for Compline, so that's enough. Thank you for your attention.